She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, and I hope you did hear the tagline, "We don't tell you what to think, we just want you to," and I promise you we are going to give you a lot to think about today. You're definitely going to want to download this podcast to your iPad and listen to it more than once. Thank you so much for joining us today. The show is sponsored by the University of Arizona, a partnership that we really value greatly at Mrs. Green's World, because we're proud to be a part of sharing with our international community how the U of A has indeed a very strong commitment to focusing on our future. And my in-studio guest today is Diana Liverman, and I told her I was going to say the whole thing so that you know just who we are talking with. She is co-director of the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment with Jonathan Overpeck. Diana has a PhD in geography from the University of California, Los Angeles. That would be UCLA for us Wildcat fans. She is a Regents Professor of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona. She is also associated with the Center for Latin American Studies and the Arid Lands Program, and there's more. She is a visiting professor of Environmental Policy and Development, School of Geography and Environment, and Senior Research Fellow, Environmental Change Institute at Oxford University. So needless to say, we are very pleased to have you, Diana. Thanks for taking the time out of your very sparse sleeping schedule, I'm sure, to be here with Mrs. Green today. Diana's going to be talking with us today about the interconnectedness in our world and the need to understand why it's so important. And before that, I'm going to do one very brief announcement about a company that gets that and one of our national partners and sponsors, Ecobella. For our regular listeners, you've heard me applaud them for their skincare and beauty products. They're natural, they're sustainably sourced because they get that it's part of a global economy, and they are committed to environmental stewardship at the highest level. And folks, their products work, which is really good to know. If you purchase products from Ecobella, you know that you're supporting a company that's making our world a better place with their integrated approach, and I encourage you to check them out. Visit their website, www.ecobella.com. And as I have said every week on the show, it's really important for all of us to support programs like this, companies like this, for our own health and the health of the planet. Now let's get started. Please join me once again in welcoming Diana Liverman, co-director of the University of Arizona Institute of the Environment. Diana, why don't we start with a background on the Institute of the Environment? You started it with Jonathan. So share with us what it is and its big, big mission.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be on the show. And I'm always excited to talk about what we're doing at the university. The Institute of the Environment was created about 4 years ago as a university-wide program. Our goal and our mission is to promote excellence in research on environmental issues, in teaching about the environment, and also to reach out to both the local community, the national and the global community, to inform people's decisions around the environment. I should say that the University of Arizona has been working on the environment ever since its beginning. We're a land-grant university. We've always been involved in conservation. We've got expertise in arid lands, but we'd never had a university-wide program. So we've got about 300 affiliated faculty who work on the environment all across the university. And what we try to do is to bring them together, encourage collaboration, write research grants, help support people who are teaching our thousands of undergraduates, and basically serve the whole university.
And I talk about the silo of silos. People a lot of time in academia operate in silos, and they're doing great work. You became, to me, a great visual, is the hub to connect those. Is that a fair explanation, to let other the other guy know what, you know, one researcher at the U of A science department might want to know what's happening in interdisciplinary studies in social work, or I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's one of our big goals, is to connect people across the university. And one of the joys this last year has been we've recently been able to attract more than 30 new young faculty to the university who work on the environment, everything from English to engineering, geosciences, geography. And we've been able to bring them together in collaborations and, of course, also in friendships. These are new people to Tucson. It's fun for them to meet people across the university. So this builds on U of A's long tradition of interdisciplinarity. Half the time I'll meet someone and I won't know which department they're in, or they'll have three different affiliations.
Right.
What matters is that they're working on environment. And our definition of the environment is broad. It includes energy, it includes water, it includes conservation. So it's a really great group of people, and it's a privilege to work with them.
And it really does talk about, I mean, it coalesces the idea of a global community, which is one of your mantras. We are a global community, and any segregation is a legend in our own mind at this point, the way that I have seen the world in the past 6 years. So what about the importance of science in the integration of the other disciplines and teaching scientists how to convey their message, not just to the public, but to their peers? Because scientists speak a certain language and they do research, and sometimes the gem is in the sharing, but they're not as good at sharing as they are at doing the research and creating change. Does that make sense?
Yes, and certainly, University of Arizona Environmental Science is global in many ways. We've been able to recruit experts from all over the world. Students come from all over the world. Our scientists are working in every region of the world, though the majority have a focus actually on the Southwest US, but we do work everywhere. But in terms of scientists communicating what they do, the Institute of the Environment is very interested in helping our scientists communicate with the rest of the world in ways that are understandable. We've got a very strong connection to Latin America, for example. We work with a lot of Latin American universities, but we also maintain a webpage for the rest of the world to find out about what's going on at U of A. So if you come to portal.environment.arizona.edu, you can find out about everything that's going on at the University of Arizona. We run a listserv. We connect very strongly to University of Arizona's area studies centers. So we've got centers of expertise on Latin America, the Middle East, arid lands, the developing world, and we work very closely with them as well. And I think U of A, it sees itself as a global and international university, but particularly with connections to other arid regions of the world, where we can all work together to understand how to live sustainably in the arid regions of the world.
Which I would say are probably ever increasing.
Yes.
So there's a little, not any irony there, just the facts. Now, I think it's really exciting that you are going to get a beautiful new building, and I think it brings a level of maybe recognition of the importance of the value of the mission. It's important to have a building where people can come. Do you think there's a message that will help? You've recruited great people. Is it important to them to know they're coming to their own building? I mean, talk about the importance of having an Institute of the Environment, literally.
Well, we are very excited about the new building. It's the Environment and Natural Resources building on campus. We've been promised a building for decades, I think. The Institute has always been spread out across campus, makes it hard for us to bring people together. Now we're joining several other departments that have a strong environmental focus in the new building, which will also have the largest classroom on campus and facilities that can be used for a conference center. But what really excites me about the building is the design and the fact that it's going to be very sustainable.
Talk about that. It's a really, and it's a hot, hip design as
great. It was really exciting to be on. I was on the committee that helped select the architects. It was a national competition. And Rashad Bauer, who's based in Phoenix, partnered partnered with a company in Tucson, and they won the competition. And what convinced us was a beautiful building design, which is around the idea of a slot canyon, a deep canyon like the Grand Canyon. And it's both beautiful because it's got curved lines, but it's also very sustainable because it creates a lot of shade and a lot of coolness. And I think it's going to be a beautiful building. So the actual design of the building, five floors, is beautiful. We've got a conference room on the roof, and the roof will be, we hope, a green roof if we can raise some of the money put that together. We'll be able to bring people together from all across campus for workshops and talks. So there'll be an auditorium that's dedicated to environmental workshops, environmental lecture series. And the building is very low energy use. We're going to collect all of the rainwater and the air conditioning water, which will be used to irrigate on campus. There's going to be all recycled materials to the extent we can use possible. So we're really doing everything we can, not just to get LEED Platinum certification, but to have the building be somewhere where we can actually show students that we're practicing what we preach. And because we'll have a 600-seat classroom, there will be thousands of students coming into that building every day. And I'm excited about designing the display exhibits, for example, for them to see what goes on in the building, even if that's not their particular interest.
It's so exciting for me as well, being I am a University of Arizona alum. But the other thing that I'm really glad you mentioned is something that I have been critical of the University of Arizona. I'm really glad you picked someone from Phoenix and Tucson to mm-hmm. be partners with, because to me, I understand the need for a national search, but especially for what this building stands for, to go out of state, to me, would have been a huge disconnect. So I'm really glad that I like the happy ending of that story, mm-hmm. because let's keep it local and keep the talents. There is enough talent in Phoenix and Tucson to do what you're doing, and that makes me really, really proud of the U of A. What about, are there any other exciting highlights before we go into the next section, which I want to talk about your book, World Regions in a Global Context, in terms of, since you started at the Institute establishing new programs, you said there are 30 new faculty. Do you have a couple of highlights that you just want to share with everybody that you want to shout from the rooftops or through the airwaves? You get excited about all of them.
I could talk about all 30 faculty because they're all great.
I believe you could.
If I just took a few highlights, one cluster I'm excited about is the new younger scholars that work on renewable energy, including economists, people who are helping us move to a lower carbon energy economy. We've got another cluster working in public health who work on environment and health. We've partnered with Biosphere 2 to help recruit young scientists who will use this really innovative facility we have at U of A to do research on water in arid lands. We've been able to bring in people who teach environmental creative writing, Chris Kokinos and others. So they're really terrific, and they are doing very well. They're teaching popular courses, and they're already starting to bring in some major research grants. So Brian Mayer, new hire in sociology, has worked on the aftermath of the BP Horizon oil spill. He's now working on Hurricane Sandy, looking at how communities are affected by disasters. So we've just got a great group. So that's one thing I'm very excited about. But I'm also excited about the way we've built the graduate student networks. So we have the Carson Fellows Program, which gives scholarships to students who are willing to learn how to communicate their environmental research to the public. And we're very grateful you support that program and help the students learn how to communicate better. But we've now got 33 Carson Fellows who are going out and changing the world. It's wonderful to see those sort of things grow and multiply.
I would love you to expand on that a little bit, because I want to invite more people from Tucson to come and hear the presentations. And what you have been so successful at is taking these students, some of whom are extremely funny, like Scatman, who I'll never forget for the rest of my life. I mean, he had everybody.
Ashwin.
He had everybody in the audience just, you know, basically had a Scatman shirt and studies scat, which is important. I mean, he was really great. And then you have other people, bright, bright minds, articulating, making things that I would find boring, I admit, very minutia-driven, you know, scientific data, and making it interesting and engaging for the people. And I know you help train them to do that, to get people excited about science.
Yeah, well, we bring in people to actually train them how to communicate, how to write for a more popular audience. Provide venues. So one of the things that we did the last year was the science cafes are actually one of the bars in Tucson, where some of these students talked about their research to customers in one of the local bars. And it was very successful. People were fascinated.
So smart. I mean, that is so really spot on and modern to do that. I think that's awesome. And I don't know why I didn't get invited, but we'll get back to that off air. But that's meeting people where they are is really important. And that's what the people that I've invited to the Carson Scholars Program, they're hooked. Yeah. I mean, they really get hooked because it makes science exciting and important and relatable.
Yeah,
I think that's a huge word.
We're talking about making it not just a UA program, but connecting with some other universities in the West to sort of spread this idea of teaching great young science communicators. So let's put a link on your website if people want to find out more about it.
I think that is a really great idea. I mean, anything that I can do to support it, because the thing that makes it really important for me is feeling that I'm a part of doing something. Like, there's so much information out there, and what can I do to help make a difference? Well, supporting a Carson Scholar is a really great step to do that. And I think I go and it gives me hope for the future. And I think a lot of people shut down about, you talk about climate change, you talk about global warming, you see this look. And basically, it's not whether they believe it or not, they don't want to deal with it. And these kids make you want to know more and ask questions, and nobody ever leaves early. Now, I'm going to start before we go to a break, because there'll be enough here to cover about your book, which you gave me. It's called World Regions in a Global Context. It's the fifth edition. And even though we talked a little bit about this off air, the book is meant for teachers and students. To me, it became something that I kept turning the pages and reading more about. It is not written like a novel. It's very fact-based, but it does draw you in. And I am certainly not a scientist, but it does start to represent so strongly the global interconnection. So can you expand on the concept of what it means as it relates to the book and your message as Diana Liverman?
Yeah, well, this is a book that we actually wrote the first edition 20 years ago, and it was inspired by my friends Sally Marston and Paul Knox, who are co-authors, they had already written a fairly successful undergraduate text, and they were asked by the publisher, would we be willing to do a text that could be used for teaching basically freshman students about world regions and connections and global geography. And so even 20 years ago, it was so much fun to try to come together and design a book that would be a little bit different. And so rather than treat each region separately, so to say, this is Africa, here's all the facts and figures, what people think of as sort of slightly boring geography.
Right, right.
And to rather than do it that way is to actually look at the way in which regions are connected and how one region shapes another and vice versa. And so in the book, we do go region by region around the world, and we've now got five authors. It's a textbook with Prentice Hall. It's used probably to teach about 30,000 or more students a year all around the US and the world, hopefully more. But what we did was we thought about themes that connected regions. So the sort of things that we look at in the book are the way in which the environment is connected from one region to another. So how does the impact on the environment in China affect other parts of the world? How does US environmental impacts affect Latin America? We also look at the connections of people. So the way in which culture and people move around around the world. So we look at migration. We look at the political connections. So one of the big stories in the book is actually the legacy of the colonial period when the Spanish and the British and the French dominated most of the world. And even though we've decolonized the world, there are still echoes that connect those countries to each other. And what's really exciting about the book is we revise it every 3 years or so because the world is changing. And for me, what's fascinating is I write the Sub-Saharan Africa chapter, the Latin America chapter, and the Australia and the Pacific chapter. And every time it changes dramatically. And I can give you some examples perhaps after the break.
When we come back from the break. But this is what I want to know. I did read a lot of the fine print. I didn't do a quick study of this book. You gave it to me about a month ago. It's not a book you sit down and read, but I looked at it and looked at it. Mm. One of the things I noticed in the preface is that you can count on the facts being accurate. Mm-hmm. It said every single thing that is written in this book was reviewed and verified. So it's something that you can count on, that reliability, a source that you can trust. And I thought, given that there were five authors and that it was the fifth edition, that was noteworthy.
We're pretty obsessive about trying to get the facts right. And if we don't get them right, we hear from our readers.
People call them out.
Yeah. And we thought about actually having a prize for an undergraduate who could identify any error whatsoever, because that would get it really right.
That's a really good idea. And knowing some of those Carson scholars, they would find it. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more of some examples of the world region. And everybody, I know that you're as intrigued as I am, and we are getting a lot to think about. My in-studio guest is Diana Liverman, co-director of the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment with Jonathan Overpeck. And I certainly like to mention Peck because he is a world-renowned scientist, and they are doing incredible things for all of us. So please stay here with me. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, and I'll just do a little shout out. Go to the Institute of the Environment's Facebook page. It's one thing that I'd like to put throughout the show to remind people how to stay connected. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back.
University of Arizona professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. The 2013 VW Jetta TDI is the sedan people love to love. It comes with a zippy turbocharged diesel engine that's 90% cleaner burning than previous diesel engines, and it goes farther on a tank of gas than a Toyota Prius. Chapman Volkswagen has a great selection of Jetta TDIs, so choose yours today at ChapmanTucson.com or in person at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson.
You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives?
Well, it's true.
It's true.
Well, it's true.
Goodwill.
Goodwill gave my son a chance.
My mom, hope.
My brother, a sense of purpose.
And help my dad find a job.
Goodwill helps thousands of people.
People like us every year.
People like us.
Every year.
Your donations to Goodwill do change lives. Please donate today.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And our in-studio guest today, Diana Liverman, is giving us a lot to think about. She is the co-director of the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment with Jonathan Overpeck. She is really making a lot of things happen with her amazing team, with her students, with the new professors that she has brought in, and the professors that have been there that are connecting. It's really making a global buzz. And I just want to add that she's also a visiting professor of environmental policy and development, School of Geography and Environment, and Senior Research Fellow, this is a mouthful, Diana, Environmental Change Institute at Oxford University. So there's the global view that I like to throw into the show. So let's go back to the world regions and global context. And you said you could give a couple of examples of the global connectivity from some of the regions.
Yeah, well, first I should give a shout out to my co-authors, Sally Marston, Paul Knox,
yes,
Vinnie Del Casino, and Paul Robbins, who are both friends and great intellects.
And they're the same four that have been with you since the first
edition? No, we started with three.
Okay.
And then we thought we needed to represent more regions. And Vinnie's an expert on Southeast Asia. Paul is an expert on South Asia. And that really added a lot of
big regions
depth
to include.
Yeah. And they also have other expertise that is great. So one example for me, because I write the Sub-Saharan Africa chapter, and I was born in West Africa, so I've always been fascinated by the problems of African development. And one of the big points we make in the Sub-Saharan Africa chapter is that Africa is not a country. It's a lot of very different countries.
Right.
And that's one of the things we try to look at in the chapter is the variations across Africa. But in this edition, the thing that struck me looking at the data was how much better off large parts of Africa were in the last 5 or 6 years, that the improvement in the basic indicators of literacy, of economic development, of the status of women, of health, they've all improved. And the AIDS infection rates dropped. The AIDS death rate has dropped. And some of that is because of global connections. I mean, certainly there were elements of colonialism and resource exploitation that created poverty in Africa. But one of the things that had a big impact was the debt forgiveness, because part of the reason many African countries were in such desperate conditions, they couldn't provide services, is they were paying debt. And in the last 5 years, there was a global movement, the Jubilee Movement, to forgive debt. A large number of African countries had their debt forgiven, and this has allowed them then to invest in their people, in their economy, in their resources. So that was sort of good news. And it's funny because some people don't want to hear that. They say, oh, no, it's still terrible. But I'm always looking for, you know, signs of hope. And I don't want students to write off Africa as a basket case or as a sort of a victim. I want people to understand there's a section in the Africa chapter where I write about the role of African women and how entrepreneurial they are and how they do most of the agriculture. So there is an example of the connection of debt. I mean, another example would be obviously climate change, which is my area of expertise. The way in which emissions in one part of the world, because the atmosphere is uniformly mixed, it's connected.
Right.
The greenhouse gases in one region are changing the global climate and affecting people in another part of the world. So what we do in the US is affecting people on the remotest Pacific Islands. And that's a very clear connection. And then the final example that is always an interesting part of researching the book is that we like to look at products that people are familiar with, like coffee or diamonds, and talk about how they shaped a region and shaped the world. So the story coffee looks at not just what it means in Latin America and the way it transforms lives, but the way in which the whole coffee production system has changed. And in fact, the livelihoods of coffee producers in Latin America have been affected by lower prices, which resulted from Vietnam starting to grow coffee. And so these are just one farmer in one region affecting the livelihood of a farmer in another region. And then the role of the big coffee companies in moving towards fair trade coffee. Those are global connections, regional connections that we're all part of every time we buy a cup of coffee or we buy an engagement ring. Make sure that you don't buy blood diamonds that are,
right,
come from conflict,
right,
areas. All of that's discussed in the book. And the reason we do that is it's fascinating, but it's also things that students get interested in, because this is about how their everyday consumption connects them to other parts of the world.
And this is kind of a little sidebar, but one of the things that's encouraging to me is the transparency that has been, you know, provided to us with social media, because another one of my hot buttons is, where is chocolate sourced? Mm-hmm. It's another one that's a heinous example in its abusive way. But if you're buying fair trade chocolate, you know that no young child was abducted to make my piece of chocolate. I want to know that it's fair trade. And I, you know, I've put lots of posts up about Hershey's, and they're getting, the global community is saying, you can't do this anymore, or we're not going to buy your Hershey's Kisses.
Well, I'm particularly interested in chocolate because I was born in Ghana, which is one of the major chocolate producers. So ever since I was a little kid in elementary school, I used to give talks about cocoa and chocolate. And one of the things that's been interesting in my career is to get to the point where I actually get to meet Mars or I get to meet Cadbury's and talk to them about sustainability issues and paying, you know, fair trade prices. And I do think that there are companies out there that are moving towards much more socially and environmentally justice production. And we need to look at them and support them if that's what we, the way we want to try and change things.
Change the world. And it is as simple. When you talk about interconnectivity, it is, where is your chocolate bar from? We get ours at Trader Joe's and they're fair trade certified and they're $2 for a big chocolate bar. So like, I have guilt-free chocolate in my life. It's a really good thing to feel about.
Well, I feel guilty about chocolate, but it's usually because I've eaten it, not where it came from.
No, when I'm out, I'm not as, I don't discriminate as much, but at least when I'm purchasing, it is. And I am a true certifiable chocoholic, but therefore, the films that I saw, the expose films, were very upsetting and unsettling to me. And I really then talked to it with the Mrs. Green's World community saying, even be careful where you get your chocolate and don't have Hershey's Kisses all over the place for your Easter bunny. It's, where did your Easter bunny come from? Okay, is there anything else you'd like to add about the book, World Regions in a Global Context? It helped me to know how you did it and then who checks the facts, not just you. Is that students help?
Well, because it's a best-selling textbook for Prentice Hall, we have a wonderful team who works with us. One of the most enjoyable parts of doing the book, that we always seem to do it at the last minute, is choosing the illustrations, because they've given us a budget that allows us to purchase, you know, stock photos, beautiful photos. And I really want students to see the places that we're talking about. We have students who help us as research assistants on the book. But we also use a lot, the data now compared to 20 years ago, there's too much. I mean, we have to be very careful not to use Wikipedia all the time to check things.
Right.
We go usually to the UN. One of the biggest challenges that's actually a challenge for scientists is that almost all the data is national. And big countries like Brazil or Ethiopia, there's a lot of differences within them. So one of the biggest challenges is trying to get more detailed data. And that's a challenge not just for us in the textbook, but for people who are trying to understand the world in general. And ironically, one of my best resources the first time I wrote the book, because I wanted to find out about specific places, were the Lonely Planet travel guides. I bought all the Lonely Planet travel guides.
That's a great idea.
Because they actually talk about specific places in ways that a lot of this aggregator doesn't.
In minute detail, how to get there and where to eat and what you're eating. That's a great idea. And they're still available. I'm sure there's an app for that now that you can use. But oh my gosh, that really goes back. Okay, I'm glad you added those things. So let's talk about, there are a lot of areas in which you have great expertise and vast experience. And I don't say don't be humble about it, because it's absolutely true. When you talk about, this is something of great interest, I think, to people, climate change and national security. And I went to hear Rachel Maddow speak about, her whole presentation was about the military and veterans, more specifically veterans. And you asked a question, which was whether climate change was or should be a national security priority, and whether there is a risk that involving the national security agencies in responding to climate change would militarize the issue and create more conflict. And I'd really like you to take as much time as you want to talk about that complex subject, but really important for all of us.
Yeah. Well, it's an issue I'm really interested in, and I've been interested in it for a couple of decades. I was fortunate soon after I finished my PhD to get a postdoctoral fellowship from the MacArthur Foundation, and it was to look at the issue of environment and security. And it was when climate change was starting to emerge as an issue. And I spent some time looking at Mexico and whether environmental change in Mexico would be destabilizing at local, national, and international levels. And then I came to the conclusion that we didn't have a lot of evidence one way or the other. And there was some indication, especially along the US border, that environmental change was promoting cooperation as much as conflict. We've got all these great institutions that were established to manage water across the border, to manage biodiversity across the border, and communities cooperate across the border. And so I've always felt that we hadn't done the scientific research to know whether when you have a major drought or you have some sort of competition over water, that you might get as much cooperation as you would conflict. And one example was the Mekong River in Southeast right. Asia, where they cooperated even during the Vietnam War when they were fighting with each other to manage the Mekong. So increasingly now, over the last 5 or 10 years, a lot of popular writers, people like Tom Friedman, for example, or Jared Diamond, have given the sense that environmental change in the past has caused war, has caused massive migrations. And I've always been a little bit skeptical because I think, well, what is the evidence? What about, we need to weigh it. We need to look right. at when the environment changes, don't just look for the cases that support your argument. And even just a couple of weeks ago, there was a big paper in Science that received a lot of attention that synthesized and said, oh, yes, there is evidence that climate change causes conflict. But they never looked at the cases where there was climate change and there wasn't conflict. So that's the scientific perspective. In terms of the risk of militarizing the environment, I think the concern there is that if we do think that another country is changing the environment in ways that affect our security, it could be a justification for military intervention. And interestingly enough, the Brazilians, for a long time, the Brazilian military had a story that was that the US would invade the Amazon in order to stop deforestation. And this was a serious part of Brazilian military policy. And of course, when you start to get that sort of suspicion that the US is going to sort of intervene with their military to try and stop you cutting down your forests, I think that can lead to global tensions that are not necessarily productive. On the other hand, of course, when the military pays attention to the environment, it does mean it's a very high political priority. But in a way, what I would like to see is the military being concerned, but other agencies being the ones that do something about it.
And I think Brazil is a perfect example because there are global agencies that are committed to the preservation of the rainforest, and they're doing great jobs without the government being involved. They're raising hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're helping to work with those governments. And you're right, it's a very non-threatening way if, you know, the Pachamama Alliance comes in or the Rainforest Alliance instead of the U.S.
Well, there are some tensions that can arise if there's, you know, we have to respect sovereignty in
right,
a way.
Right.
And so there was the example, I think we write about it in the World Regions book, of the chap that ran Patagonia, Doug Tompkins.
Yes.
Bought this very large area of Chile to protect the forest in Chile. But the Chileans felt quite threatened because it was almost right across their country and it was foreign ownership. I mean, I suppose people in this country would not feel very comfortable if the rest
of
the world...
We don't. When you hear that people from, you know, other countries are buying most of New York or L.A., people don't like it. You're right.
Yeah. It's like, and it's one of the reasons, you know, when we talk about global campaigns, I think it's really important to ask, what do the people in that country want us to do?
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
So rather than to sort of judge. And I think sometimes we in the developed world make judgments about what's appropriate and what the right wage is or what the right way of managing the environment is. And we need to listen.
And it's funny, but because my background was in managing large volume mental health contracts, and one of the things that we did differently than every other agency is we went in and asked families who are at risk, what do you need? Mm-hmm. How can we help you? Not, we have the answer to solving your problems, and the magic then begins, and the trust is established. Can you give an example in the regions in which you are the specialist, the expert, where agencies have come in this context in an appropriate way to help?
Oh, I think there are a lot of examples. I mean, one of my the groups that I support is Oxfam International. It's part of my link to my job at Oxford. Is that Oxfam was created to deal with natural disasters,
and it's OXFAM.
OXFAM.
Okay.
And there's Oxfam International. There's Oxfam America, but they have thought a lot about what are the appropriate ways to intervene, and they work on climate issues. They work on natural disasters, but they've got years of experience that have taught them that you're going to do a better job of long-term recovery if you work with people, if you buy the food from local farmers. I mean, there's this big debate about US food aid and about whether we should be giving food to people or giving them the resources to grow the food themselves. So there's an example of where all over the world, I think Oxfam's doing a good job.
It's a really good one. And I can't believe that we just got the 2-minute warning again. But when we come back, I'd like to talk some things about the human dimension of global change and some of the things like I talked to you about vulnerability and adaptation. Climate change as it relates to food security, it's something that people, their ears perk up. What do you mean climate change and food security and connecting that dot? And I've got a longer list to talk about when we get back. So you're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. Time is flying because we are getting a lot to think about. My in-studio guest is Diana Liverman, who is the co-director of the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment with Jonathan Overpeck. Please stay here with me. We will be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Castle Rock Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
She's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to spend eternity with her. She deserves nothing less than the best, an Abbott Taylor original. A diamond engagement ring as exceptional as she is that will make her eyes sparkle every time she sees it. Because we design and make our own jewelry, we can create something wonderful for every budget. I'm Abbott Taylor. I'd like to invite you to come see what Abbott Taylor Jewelers has waiting for you. With 35 years and thousands of original jewelry designs, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. We're proud to say using recycled gold, we have saved over 100 million pounds of toxic waste from this planet. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
It's got advanced technology. It's got major breakthroughs in technology everywhere you look. It's the 2013 Honda Accord. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I want to share with you that after nearly 40 years of heritage, this is the most stunning Accord ever. The highly respected Automotive Magazine raves that the 2013 Honda Accord offers unparalleled talent of goodness. Please visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson to check it out and see for yourself.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Are you thinking about swapping out your old items for new? Think Habitat when you do. Don't trash it. Have a store it. Habitat for Humanity Tucson will resell your donated furniture, appliances, and building supplies and use the proceeds to build affordable homes in the greater Tucson area. Call now at 520-889-7200 for a free pickup. You can bring your donations to Habitat's Have a Store at 935 West Grant Road, just a quarter mile east of I-10. For more information, go to habitattucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thank you so much for joining us today. Please remember to visit my website at mrsgreensworld.com because you will find lots of information about sustainability on a global scale. The copies of our podcast live there, so you can download podcasts. And with me today is someone who is working tirelessly to make our planet a more sustainable place for all of us. Her name is Diane Liverman. She is the co-director of the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment. And before we end up running out of time, I want to do a little shout out about next week's show because I'm really excited about that. It's about a small group of dedicated individuals changing the world. They actually reached out to me. It's called the Crayola Color Cycle Program, and my guests are going to be Land Wilson, who's a teacher, and Mariana Stanley, who is a student at Sun Valley Elementary School in California, and they literally were kind of ignored by Crayola, but then got their attention by starting a national petition about recycling colored markers, and now they have the Crayola Color Cycle Program. And you know me, I love to talk about stories that are grassroots that got a giant like Crayola to pay attention, and it was students that did it. So please join us next week at noon at mrsgreensworld.com. Okay, Diana, let's talk about vulnerability and adaptation. Explain for everybody who's listening what that means, because nobody really wants to be vulnerable.
Well, my own interest in vulnerability came out of the interest I developed as a student in understanding why people suffered during natural disasters. I'd always found it very difficult to see the suffering and famine and after earthquakes. And initially, I thought it was all about the sort of geophysical event, the severity of the drought, the severity of the earthquake. But then as a student, I started to study damages from natural disasters and what caused them. And I started to understand that you could have the same physical magnitude of a disaster in two different places, and it would be devastating in one and would have very little impact in the other. And the difference was that one place, the people were more vulnerable than the other. So vulnerability might be being poor, not having the resources right to recover or have insurance. It might mean you're living in a poor building. It might mean that you don't have the information or the money to build your house in a safe place. It might mean that you're a place where the government services don't reach out to you. And we've had some really powerful examples over the last few years
in this country,
whether it's Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and the their vulnerability was so clear that people were living in poor environments.
Squalor.
They weren't getting the services they needed. But then again, in Hurricane Sandy, we saw a much wealthier area of the country where people were very vulnerable because of where they had built their houses or because the recession, they don't have the money to rebuild them. And then in my work in Latin America, where I work with farmers, you can really see how the poorer farmers don't have the money to get an irrigation system. They can't, if they don't, crop doesn't get harvested, they don't have enough money to plant it the next year. So we are all vulnerable, but to different extents. And the question of adaptation, if we're looking at natural disasters and climate change and drought, is what resources can we provide to people, including having them think about the resources they have themselves, so that they can not just survive but thrive during these difficult periods, during weather variability. And so I've become very interested not in just in what makes people vulnerable, but what sorts of strategies can they use to adapt. And that ranges everything from the rancher in southern Arizona to the homeowner on the coast of New Jersey to the conservation manager who's got to figure out how their national park gets through sustained drought that we're having at the moment. And this is an area that at the Institute of Environment, we've put an enormous amount of energy into trying to understand this challenge of adaptation. And we now are working on projects for the Department of Interior about how we adapt wildlands in the West to climate change. We're doing work for the Department of Defense, looking at adaptation on defense lands, because they've got large areas of land where they're seeing warmer temperatures, wildfires. And so we're trying to help people think through, if we're not going to stop climate change, and we might slow it, but it's not looking great that we're going to...
It's really not looking great.
Yeah, so that means we've got to think about how to adapt to climate change. So one of the things I'm excited about is that my colleague Kathy Jacobs has been working in Washington for the last 4 years on national adaptation. She's coming back to the university, and part of her coming back is we're going to launch a national center for looking at adaptation to climate, where we'll bring together all of this expertise to try to particularly think about how the Western US might cope with a warming and perhaps more extreme climate, because it's really important for cities, for individuals. We need to think about the ecosystems that are being stressed.
And to me, there's a certain applicability, even if it isn't a climate change or a natural disaster, because when I think of, you know, Fukushima or the BP mm-hmm. oil spill, the vulnerability factor and the adaptability is probably still a lot of similarities in terms of the poor are going to suffer yeah. more and the rich can, you know, or the more stable can rebuild faster. So it's not yeah. just the natural disasters right. that are...
But also, it's not always as simple as rich and poor, because you right. look at, in some cases, like in California, some of the greatest damage is to the houses that are built on the ocean or at the urban...
And in New Jersey.
Yeah, or urban-rural interface where, you know, people build big houses out near the forests. But I am very interested, and one of the new projects that I'm hoping to work on is to understand in particular how the more disadvantaged groups within the US and within the industrial world are affected by climate change. And I became very aware of that this summer, talking to some people about their air conditioning bills, because we had, you know, June, we had every day was above 100 degrees Fahrenheit here, which was much above normal.
It was awful.
And I was looking at my own air conditioning bill. And then I started thinking about the people in South Tucson who are in poorly built houses, who are low income, and thinking about the choices they must be making about whether to let their children be cool or have a sleepless night in those temperatures. And what could we do to help people adapt? But I feel as though one of the ways we're going to feel climate change in the Southwest is not directly, but it's going to be through our utility bills, through our water bill, through our food bill, through our energy bill. And we need to think about efficiencies that allow people perhaps to have more efficient air cooling systems in their houses.
And I can't imagine for a region like Tucson, where water is basically free. We don't pay for water. We pay for the infrastructure to people to read the meter. But water is, I've been to many presentations, it's so inexpensive. Our water bill is nothing. Whereas our electricity bill, everybody's going to have to brace for a rate increase, which mm-hmm. was just approved. So it's really, you're right, it has a bottom line socioeconomic impact, but an impact on the quality of lives. And it costs lives. I mean,
yeah,
people die from
everyday lives.
And
I think
everyday lives.
I also think about the people who work outside in the heat waves, which are the contractors and the gardeners, and you know, the health problems that they have.
People putting on roofs.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. it's you have no idea what it's like unless you really get to be outside. And a lot of us run from our air-conditioned home to our air-conditioned car. I write about that on Mrs. Green's World Facebook page. Yeah. It's like, have some gratitude today and see what you can do. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a fun piece because we don't have a lot of time left. And all this to me was extremely important and relevant, and you translate it to understandable levels very well. You like to talk about art and climate change. Let's talk a little bit about the fun part of that.
Well, I got involved in that when I was back in Oxford. And it was partly I met some people at a dinner party who were artists, and we started talking about art as a way of communicating about the environment. And we decided to organize a workshop which would bring together artists and climate scientists to talk about climate change and to try and learn from each other. And one of the things I learned pretty rapidly is that artists just, they don't want to be just the PR people. They want to provide inspiration and insights.
Right,
so
right.
I learned how to work with artists. So as a result of that workshop, I got involved with a bunch of different organizations. One is a group called Cape Farewell that takes scientists and artists to the Arctic to work together, to do field work, to do art. And Cape Farewell has had some of the world's, you know, amazing people go, like the sculptor Anthony Gormley, the author Ian McEwan, and I've been privileged to like meet them through my, I'm on the board for Cape Farewell. But I also work with a group called Julie's Bicycle. They're trying to take the heat out of music. They're working with the music industry to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from bands touring, from orchestras, from theaters. And I find it enjoyable, first of all, because they the artists and the musicians have a vision and a passion that
scientists
don't
have. And they're excited
about
it, yes.
And
yes.
We can give them insights as well. So, in fact, one of the things I did yesterday was one of the Cape Farewell artists is musician Katie Tunstall, and she released her new album yesterday, and I was listening to it on iTunes, sort of looking for hints that would change the way she thinks about the environment and climate change. So now we're trying to do stuff in Tucson and in the West. We've got a program at the university where we've brought in people from the fine arts and humanities. We've got a network. We're thinking about trying to organize some workshops here. Because it's a different way to communicate and think about climate change. And the scientists aren't always the best communicators. Maybe the artists and the writers can inspire people and provide more positive visions of what a sustainable world's like.
I mean, yeah. It really is. It's a great entree to get the message out and to get people excited. And then maybe you have to get them ready. That's how I feel. It's like start with don't use plastic bottles and then get right to the hole we're putting in the sky with that we're burning through fast.
Yeah.
Let's talk another one of my favorite things. And for people that might have just tuned in, what would be like two or three quick calls to action for people that are listening, for those in Tucson and those around the country in terms of getting engaged? If they are taking away one thing, what would you say, go out and do this? Would it be visit your university? Would it be follow an environmental group? Would it be find out if you have a similar thing to a Carson Scholar program?
Well, I think being informed is important, especially if you're going to have conversations with your neighbors about climate change,
yourself.
That sort of thing. So educate yourself, whether that be through the web or going to lectures at your local university or reading. There are so many resources now. And be educated and then be prepared to be able to argue the case against somebody who says we shouldn't act. I mean, this is if you've decided one should act. I think other things to do are to think about the way you consume and to purchase sort of sustainably produced items and to let companies know that you want them to be more sustainable if that's what you've chosen to try to promote. And then be open to your children and younger people who want to talk to you about the environment and support them in choosing a greener future. Because in a way it's, you know, I don't want to say this, it's almost too late for us, it's the next generation. And that's why things like the Carson Fellows Program, supporting students at the university, but also working with little kids, K-12, like the School Gardens Program we have in Tucson. All of that, I think, allows them to make perhaps better choices than we did. And finally, we do need technology innovation as well. I think that business and technology are also part of the solution. And so we need to support at all levels the sort of technology innovation that we need for a more sustainable world. But easy thing, turn down your thermostat a little bit, use your water more efficiently, ride your bike. These are all
little small steps that collectively add up to a huge, really big impact. And that's what I say over and over and over. Small steps, big impact. We can do it. I know I'm not the one that coined that phrase. But anyway, thank you, Diana Liverman, for taking the time to be with us. I'm sure those of us that are that were listening and participating in this know it was a precious hour for her to give with the board she's on and the global thought leader that she is. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And thanks to the University of Arizona for supporting the work of Mrs. Green's World.
Thank you.
Make it a great green week, everybody.